Hello, I'm Jesse Roman Herrera. I'm 35. Today's date is Monday, October 21st, 2019. Recording here out of Dallas, Texas, but I'm originally from Fort Worth, Texas. And the name of my interview partner is Amanda Arizola. She's a dear friend of mine and current business partner. Mm-hmm.
And I'm Amanda Arizola, age 39. Today's date is Monday, October 21st, 2019. We are located in Dallas, Texas, and I am interviewing Jesse Herrera, and he is my business partner and friend of 10 plus years.
Yeah, give or take. Okay. It's been a while.
It has been a while. I'm all like, and sometimes I wonder how we even still our friends. We come from such diverse backgrounds, and even though we both grew up in Fort Worth, we have different life experiences. So why don't you start telling me about your life experience?
So before I can go a little bit into my life experience, I guess I should share a little bit about it, a little bit of the history of my family. So my mother grew up in South Texas in a small rural town called Beeville. It's roughly about 60 miles north of Corpus. There's really not a lot to do down there, and I mean, I have very vague memories of Beeville just going down there periodically to go visit family. But anywho, she grew up in the 50s in Beeville, Texas, and if anyone knew kind of the history of Texas during the 50s, rural Texas was a pretty tough place, particularly for a Latina woman, not just because of, you know, being a woman in the age of the 50s, in a rural town where her role was mainly subjugated to, you know, taking care of her future husband and taking care of the household, but also because of her culture and her language, she got a lot of, she grew up in a very hostile environment. Spanish was not really something you spoke in rural Texas unless you were rolling deep with a crew or you wanted to, you know, engage in confrontation. So speaking Spanish came with a level of threat. If you were a typically she would get picked on a lot by the non-Latino, non-Hispanic folks. And she would also get picked on a lot at school by her teachers, who would administer punishment to her, if she spoke the language. So I tell you that to tell you this. As she got out of Beeville, she got married. She started having a family on her own that left a very visible mark on her as she started raising her children. So the thing that came out of that, she taught us all English first as our primary language, primarily just to keep us from going through the same suffrage that she went through during her days in Beeville, Texas. And this came with an interesting mark on my life, which we'll get to later in the interview. So my father wasn't really a big presence in my life. He was a war-torn Vietnam veteran, and I really don't know how him and my mother came to meeting. Those are some of the things that she tends to keep to herself when she talks about Reuben. From what I gathered, the marriage was a brutal one, filled with a lot of abuse, both verbally and up to a certain point physically. And by the time I was 5 years old, the marriage was already on the decline. And an affair with a mutual friend of my father kind of sealed the deal on the marriage, and they split shortly after that. It didn't end up being too bad of a thing because I was able to, you know, meet my stepfather, Mike, who was also another mutual friend of the family. He was married at that time to my mother's best friend, and through a set of circumstances, they ended up getting divorced shortly after my parents divorced, and they reconnected shortly after, and they were married. Great man, born and raised in Philadelphia, grew up in New York, you know, spent a little bit of time in Los Angeles because his father was in the military. So he brought a lot of unique charm to the family. particularly Eastern charm.
So how did that affect your life?
So growing up, I dealt with a different set of challenges. I ended up being sent to Crowley High School through some weird redistricting, and it was a good school, but it was also a much more affluent school compared to the neighboring Fort Worth High State Campus. So growing up in the environment that I grew up in, we weren't necessarily very affluent. We were, you know, we were working class. You know, we had the basic needs. We had a roof over our head. We had food at the table. Every once in a while, maybe we'd take a trip down to South Texas to go catch up with the family. But we didn't really have a lot in terms of, you know, extra. So we ended up, how this translated to me is, going through school, I never really had quite as nice clothes as my peers. I never had quite as nice of a car as my peers. And as I started getting older, there was a reoccurring theme that kept happening. I found myself getting picked on a lot by my own Latino peers, primarily for two things. One, because I didn't speak Spanish. And two, because my stepfather was black. And because of, you know, some of the charm that he had left on me and some of the, I guess you could say, cultural traits I picked up during my life hanging out with, you know, primarily African-Americans and, you know, the at that time what I, you know, created as my core circle of influence. Another detail I forgot to mention is that at this point in time in my life, going into middle school and high school, there was a lot of dysfunction with my family. My grandfather had passed away right when I turned about 13. And because of that, he left a lot of money behind at his house, and he was very old school with it, so he didn't really believe in banks. So the money was literally stashed in the walls and beneath the floors in this house. And after the passing, my aunt, who, you know, was my favorite aunt at that time, and whose sons and daughters were my favorite cousins, proceeded to raid this house. And let me clarify, my aunt raided the house and basically took as much money as she could from the walls, the floors, the ceilings, and left the family high and dry to fend for the bills and the taxes. And it drove a really huge wedge in our family circle, where, at, you know, basically after that, we had very little family connection with South Texas. We never had any family get-togethers after that, and I never saw my cousins after that point. So going into high school, my social circle was pretty small. I didn't have a family, and because I was getting mocked a lot by my fellow Latino peers, I didn't really have a lot of friends either. So getting into high school, you know, I bumped into another group of guys going through a similar set of issues. And long story short, that turned into, you know, a 3-year journey into a very aggressive gang life. We'd hit the streets every night, you know, looking for a fight, maybe looking to sell some dope. You know, I mean, the night was always filled with mystery. We never knew what we were going to come up with. And a lot of those nights, I mean, it's really just out of sheer luck that I made it back home alive. I really can't say, you know, there was a magic bullet or a magic formula that I found that allowed me to survive. It's just sheer luck. I mean, I was in the right place at the right time, and it was just fortunate that the circumstances didn't lead to me either getting incarcerated or killed. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting transition from what at that point had been a pretty innocent life.
So you say innocent life from that. And we know in our friendship and in our business dealings, that's kind of led to what we're looking at. We had shared a lot of similarities in life, lots of things with our families together, growing strong mothers, and working in the community and seeing different things that happened. So what was your transition pivotal point from gang life to the individual that went to college, has a degree, now working in the community for systemic change?
Man, I mean, that's a lot of stuff.
Quickly.
So, I mean, I mean, I'll harp on luck, but I mean, I had, you know, amazing parents. I mean, my mother and father and my stepfather, but I call him my real father, had a pivotal role to play in this because they never really gave up on me, and they were always there to provide, you know, a stable shelter. You know, I give it up to my brother. I mean, he gave me some really good pep talks that kind of helped me get out of this situation, even though unfortunately now we're kind of going through some episodes of our relationship. I mean, I think the biggest thing really, honestly, when I look back at it, was just betrayal. I mean, the thing that got me into the gang life was really just a constant series of betrayals, you know, from, you know, previous friends, my family. And what sealed the deal with me getting out of the gang life was that same sense, you know. I felt like I had been betrayed, where I was thrown in this situation where I had to defend myself in front of a detective for something I didn't do, something I didn't even want to participate in. And that really rocked the boat with me, because, I mean, up to that point, I mean, I was willing to ride or die with these folks because I believed that I had found a family, someone that, you know, cared for me and loved for me and would go to the end of the earth to defend me. And when that happened, the reality came screaming back very viciously that, no, that's not the case. I mean, these individuals were basically using me, and I was a scapegoat. So through a fortunate series of events, a lot of my friends in the crew left to the military, left the state of Texas, got incarcerated themselves, whatever the case. But this all happened simultaneously. So it was a really good opportunity for me to also leave as well. And following that interview with the detective, I erased my number. I enrolled in college that next week, and I basically disappeared from society for 4 years as I pursued my education.
And what?
In architecture, yes, architecture.
Mm-hmm. You're very proud of that all the time.
Yeah, well, you know, I gotta rock the architecture badge every once in a while, but, you know. But it didn't come without its level of conflicts and challenges as well. I mean, leaving that life was a reset button on a whole different scale. I mean, not only did I leave my social circle, but I left that with a whole twisted perspective on humanity. And I looked at people basically as vessels of distrust. Eventually, you were going to betray me. Eventually, you were going to use me for something. So let's just get to the point and be done with this so I don't have to waste any more time for you. And it took me a very long time to get over that. And unfortunately, this is where it leads to us meeting. You met me during that period of bad time. I mean, I was a very different person when we first met. And even though I don't remember it.
How we met?
even though I don't remember this, because I was really fucked up on that day. But
let's just say there was a bottle cap in my head.
Yes, a bottle cap being flung at your head, me almost getting in a fight with your boyfriend, and, you know, a series of apology letters that I had to send out for 2 weeks after that to apologize to every member either that I spilled alcohol on, bumped into the wrong way, you know, talked about some messed up stuff, or in your case, threw bottle caps at. So, but it was really after that, and for whatever reason, which I thank God for, you know, you gave me a second chance to really, you know, rebuild myself, and I appreciate that, because over the past, you know, 10 years that followed that, I really got to learn a lot about you and, you know, the contributions you made to your community, and really, you know, the influence that your mother and your family had in your life, which is a good segue into your story.
Well, not necessarily my story itself, but kind of more the story of us and building a business and all that comes with that, and the way that we move through. I mean, I grew up very similarly here in Fort Worth and all over different opportune in different houses. I think I counted it not too long ago. Lived in 28 different rental houses and apartments. We've never had a space that was our own. And so even though we didn't move from Fort Worth itself, it's always just very different. So I get antsy when I'm in a place for too long, which really is a good basis for the work that I do and for the work that we do for the community. I spent my life giving back and understanding that things are happening. Fortunately, we never had to struggle with food, but they were always lean times. We always made it work. And that helps me now with my work that I do in the community and being able to be a nonprofit manager and learn from you those different aspects, especially from architecture and design. We come from two very different worlds, even though we come from what other people would see as the same world. I know there was something you had told me before that someone had asked you, what was it like to live in a low-income community? But you lived in the same house all your life.
I did.
How was that?
I mean, the house actually, you know, was acquired through the divorce with my father, my biological father. And I mean, it is very interesting when I do share my story about being a gangbanger, that's usually the perception as well. You came from a very hostile, very low-income family. I mean, you know, you're a survivor. You know, what's your secret? And it's like, man, it wasn't. I mean, I'm not really, in the end of things, there wasn't really nothing special about my life. It was just a set of circumstances, and I got lucky. I mean, I'll keep harping on that. I just got lucky. But growing up in the same house, I mean, it brought a certain level of stability, which I think helped in getting out of this life, because I never really had to worry about where my next meal was coming from or, you know, where I was going to stay for the night. So, I mean, there was a certain level of comfort that comes with that. And there's a certain level of, you know, luxury that I had compared to some of my other peers that went through similar things. So, I mean, I own that openly. You know, I mean, my life was, you know, pretty decent.
But I think this also is a good segue into why, even after our 10 years of friendship so far, 2.5 years ago, we decided that what we were seeing in the community wasn't enough and wasn't the right way of thinking about things. Not necessarily the right way, but a different way of thinking. So do you want to tell them about urban theory?
Yeah. So, I mean, urban theory, I think really in its core started right after I got out of college. So as Amanda mentioned, I graduated from UTA, graduated with an architecture degree, and started practicing right afterwards. And something became apparent very quickly with architecture, and that there was a very big level of separation between me as the designer and the individual that was eventually going to inhabit the space. So at this particular time in my life, I was designing multifamily, in a very specific type of multifamily, senior assisted living and independent living. So basically, you know, kind of a fancier version of a retirement home. And I never met the individuals that would eventually inhabit these spaces. So that was a little awkward to me, you know, trying to design a space for someone that I would never meet. What also became very apparent is that what I was designing was essentially a very expensive product. So some of these units would go for $750,000 to $1.2 million for basically an apartment. And I felt very disenfranchised about that, because for an individual, you know, even if they were affluent, working their entire life to raise enough money so they could have a comfortable retirement, that was a pretty substantial chunk of, you know, one's income for basically an apartment. For the other half or the majority of the population, this wouldn't even be a feasible option because the price tag was so high. So this led to, you know, me asking a question, you know, is there a way that I could actually utilize architecture to give back to the community? And the journey really started with looking at how could I create more affordable housing, more affordable developments that would help the public. Through looking deeper into this question, I realized there was a lot of creative potential that architects carried that maybe necessary didn't have to be applied to buildings. So the question became more so, how could we utilize design to facilitate impact? And through a series of trips all across the globe, one standing out in particular to Jakarta, I had the unique opportunity to hear Muhammad Yunis, a former Nobel Peace Prize winner, most renowned for the Grameen Bank, and his perspective on social enterprises and really looking at things through a system lens really resonated with me. And when I brought that lesson back, it really reinvigorated this whole question of utilizing design to facilitate impact. And as I started looking deeper into that, I think this is where a lot of our theories come and coalesce together, is I started realizing that we were trying to solve a lot of the same problems with either antiquated processes or trying to solve them in the same way that we created the problem. Additionally, I was finding out that we weren't really going beyond the symptom. I served on a couple nonprofits, getting a little bit more seasoned into my career, and we could never really get quite past the symptom. I mean, we would do these great events, we would help all these, clients out, but yet the same year afterwards, we would see the same clients. And I tried to facilitate some initiatives to go beyond that, but it was very difficult to get people to really want to get on board to change or to allocate resources, to allocate time. So ultimately what we would see would be the same resources, the same solutions, and nothing would change. So looking deeper into this question, I really wanted to know, how could we go as far into that issue as possible and really tailor a journey using these toolkits that I acquired, being an architect, being a contractor, being a real estate developer, being a teacher, and apply it to something outside of just making buildings. So really, this is a pursuit not just of, an architect, but it's a pursuit of really utilizing a professional's creative capital to do more and to do work that actually impacts society. So with urban theory, I mean, it really started at that point, but I think the pivotal change was whenever we got together about 2 years ago and we sat around, a nice lofty wood table in the autumn, drinking a couple beers, trying to, with a couple of groups, other friends at the table, trying to figure out, how could we create change? I think we were all recognizing that the similarities in our journey, we were all recognizing that we weren't really creating, the types of organizations or initiatives that would lead to change. And collectively we said, okay, well, let's just figure out how we can get this done.
Yeah, and I think that is also the different industries that we're bringing in and the ideology. So, with your design background and understanding with my nonprofit, understanding and the way that we look at things very differently, that helps us to be able to figure out what are these kind of solutions. I know I get very stubborn and very set. And then that's how we talk about it and see what's coming through. And so that brings kind of the question of, we've both seen through generational, I talk about this all the time, generational wealth and how we have not been able to move, and how in real estate, and you talk about and design, how that is moving things forward, and we just don't look at it in specific ways. So in, you brought in human-centered design, and I finally realized you were helping me explain and understand human-centered design, that's what I was already doing. Do you want to talk about some of the projects that you've been working on?
Yeah, I mean, a little deeper into human-centered design, I would agree that I think we all kind of practice this in our career, but we often term it as different things. And I think for me, I think honing that skill really came at my previous employer at Tarrant County College, where I was helping design classrooms. So the framework is really just about connecting with those that, you know, you aim to serve, those that, you know, at the end of this journey, you're aiming to help. And the two projects that we've been able to acquire since we launched have been quite interesting. One of them is focusing on addressing college homelessness, which we actually discovered by accident. We were hosting our inaugural event, which was called City Talk, and the idea was just to talk about a very pressing, unique topic that maybe most people weren't fluent with. And the topic that we chose was hostile design. So we were really looking at the ways that we intentionally and unintentionally design certain classes of people out of certain spaces. So we've seen this in different cities, and we even saw it in Fort Worth when we conducted our audit. But looking at different like little elements on like parking benches or planter boxes where you have like little bumps that prevent people from being able to sit comfortably, or having arm bars in the middle of benches so you can't sleep on a public bench, or even a real subtle detail that we found in the water gardens in Fort Worth, where there's these little bumps on the handrails that actually prevent skateboarders from being able to grind down the railing. And we brought all this information back, and we basically just, you know, presented, hey, these are the facts of our city. These are some of the elements that we found that are hostile. What do you think? And we had a very informal discussion about, you know, the hostile design. As we started kicking that concept around, and we got a little deeper into the topic, we unearthed college homelessness. One of the participants there, you know, got up as the conversation started migrating towards homelessness and whether or not we wanted individuals that were homeless in our communities. And she shared with us that she's been seeing an increasing percentage of college students experiencing homelessness. And that shut down the entire conversation because we had to take about 15 seconds to digest what we heard. Following that, we took together a series of roundtables and additional forums really to help educate folks on the need of this, you know, of pursuing this challenge, to let them know that, yes, this is a real thing, and here are some of the stories that we've been able to collect through the students that we've interviewed.
And I always find that interesting because, unfortunately, I wasn't present during that kind of, when you say, by accident. And just being in the community and knowing the work, that I was too close to it, because I already knew that the statistics of college homelessness are so high, so drastic, people don't know. And I've always been surprised by your like reactions to that, and also the reactions of the people in the room.
Well, I think a lot of us are so separated from that, because I mean, if we're not you know, engaging in social work each and every day, we never see that because we get caught up in our day to day. So it kind of made sense. I mean, even though it's not a good way to justify it, I mean, that's what you lived and breathed for 20 years. I lived and breathed construction and real estate. So that's what I knew. That's what I focused it on. And I guess what's even a bigger slap in the face is that when we originally hosted this event, I was still working for the college. So I didn't even know, as an employee of the college. Yeah. That's just how tunnel focused I was, which was a whole nother realization after, you know, doing this and like, wow, like, I really am not seeing the big picture here. So,
yeah. And it just always boggles my mind, especially as a practitioner and then also as an academic. And we can shout this from the rooftop. We can market it ourselves and we can tell people about it. But what I've noticed, especially with the roundtable discussions, that people are more willing to hear this from somebody other than a social worker, from somebody other than somebody who has a direct connection with it. So it becomes this idea of, and going back to human-centered design and that, of how do we share that story in a way that's going to be most appealing?
Yeah, and I mean, really sharing that story not only to, you know, help illuminate on the challenge, but also to help change that perceived narrative. Because I think, you know, again, I'll take myself. I mean, one would have never thought about this. We just think, okay, well, you're in college. You must have made it. You're successful. And I even had to take a step back even when I started, you know, pursuing this project and looking back at my own history and remembering very vividly that, you know, the only saving grace I had getting through college was, again, my parents. I was in a very awkward situation right into the beginning of my senior year where I had to take time off work to go work on a project in school. And, you know, unfortunately, the wood shop that I needed to build this model and this project operated at very weird hours of the day. So my only opportunity was on a Sunday that I was scheduled. I took off the day to complete my work. I completed my work, and then the next day I had to sit down with the boss, and I had to make a decision that day. You're either going to work full-time at this place, or you're going to go to school full-time, but we're not going to let you do both. So I had the luxury of being able to walk away from that job. But realizing that now, there's a lot of students that don't have that luxury, and then they get put in this awkward situation. Yeah. Where they may not technically be homeless, but they're right on the verge.
Yeah, I mean, at UT, even when I graduated from UT, my three roommates, we were evicted from our apartment. Our only saving grace was that our sorority sisters allowed us to stay in their homes while we gathered up funding to find another place, an apartment. So, you know, this project becomes very important for us and becomes very important as a foundation of what's moving forward and how we're looking at different things and how we think about the traditional means of help. I mean, that goes into from not only a community aspect and as a community activist, what do we do, but also from your perspective of design. I mean, we talk about design all the time.
Yes, and I mean, and I think this is one of the great things that architects do bring to the table that's maybe an unappreciated skill, but architects are very good at building cohorts. I mean, it's required in how we conduct our business. We have to recruit consultants. We have to coordinate with contractors. We have to tether many alignments throughout this project. And realizing, you know, some of the complexities that come with this challenge, it's no different than, you know, an architecture project. It's just that you're designing an architecture for a social solution. So that being said, I mean, this challenge that we're pursuing has a lot of different facets to it. And what we've realized, you know, collectively as we've pursued urban theory, is that all these challenges that we really aim to fix can't be solved on their own. They can't be solved in a silo. And there's a large, constantly moving network of partners that are going to be required to actually make any tangible change. Because, I mean, just giving one example, one of the students that we interviewed was previously incarcerated. I mean, that in itself is its own unique and complex challenge. Tether that with that this individual is also homeless and pursuing college. I mean, that's a plethora of issues. So yeah, it's interesting. As you start diving deeper, how interwoven these challenges become. And I mean, even getting into that, like you start getting into like food insecurity issues, which, you know, is another project that we're currently working on right now through Grow Southeast, an initiative that we helped launch. You know, we were tasked with trying to help with addressing food insecurities in Stop 6 in Fort Worth. And what became abundantly clear as we started diving deeper into that this isn't just a challenge of food, it's also a challenge of income. You know, it's very difficult to afford healthy living and, you know, kind of the day-to-day things we take for granted if you don't have any income. So as we've, you know, pursued this challenge, we've looked at it through that lens of economic development and how we can actually empower these community members that we're helping to be the vessels of their own change. So in the event that we do detach, and when we do detach, that we're no longer needed for intervention.
Right. I think that through the last couple of years with us ourselves and then also our other partner, Juan Villalpando, we have all come through some interesting conversations and debates on the perfect way or the right way or just any way to move forward and to help people understand. And one of the things that I want to say is that I'm really proud of the work that you've done and the way that you have moved forward in your life. And that everything happens for a specific reason. Everything that we've worked for, everything that comes up for, is really, really kind of the whole reason why we're here today and whole reason why we continue to do this work. I know it's tough. And we argue all the time about funding because funding is a bad word for us.
It's a tough word.
But I think that urban theory is going to strive, mostly because you have so much faith in it, and also because I believe in you. I think that'll work through.
I appreciate that.
So what do you see as our chief visionary? What do you see in the next couple of years with the arms of urban theory?
So, I mean, the current is we're basically creating a market that doesn't really exist yet in DFW. It exists in other places in the world, so we're leveraging what knowledge that we can and what advisors that we can that we've acquired through our journeys to kind of help us with these preliminary steps. But I really do see urban theory being a catalyst to really help drive social innovation and really helping spark, you know, that innovative flair and that innovative touch to addressing social challenges, and really kind of going back to that pivotal moment when I was in Jakarta and listening to Muhammad Yunus. You know, how do we utilize business and the social enterprise to really take a much more intentional step at changing the system and really being that agency that is about intervening in the system, changing the system, improving the system, and really laying the foundation so others continue the journey. Mm-hmm. I'm not naive enough to think that we can solve all the world's problems, but I do believe we can set the foundation. Mm-hmm. And that's really what I see urban theory doing in the next, you know, 10, 15 years, is being that pivotal agent to set the foundation.
Yeah. I love that Jakarta story because we were there. You were sequestered for 5 days with armed guards and everything else around you while I was out and about in little cabs and walking around the streets unprotected as a woman.
And some of the most horrific traffic we've ever seen.
horrific traffic, which led to us having some amazing dialogue and conversation and trying to really look and figure out what those complex issues and traffic issues could we change and see. And it always makes me think about the different ways in which we work and come together. So I appreciate that.
I was going to add another detail to that about a very uncomfortable massage, but maybe that's better left for another day.
Yeah, let's leave that for another day. This is, yeah. It was a great trip. We've had some amazing round-the-world trips. And we'll continue to bring these issues back to our communities and work through. Yeah. So I'm proud to be part of Urban Theory, soon to have a nonprofit arm with COACT, and to walk alongside you with this journey.
I appreciate it. I mean, it's been a hell of a making, and I mean, it hasn't always been the easiest journey, but, you know, we both bring a tenacity and a fierceness to this work that's going to be necessary to carry through. And it's been a pleasure learning about you. It's been a pleasure working alongside you. But I think more so it's been a pleasure just having the honor to call you my friend.
Aww. Yay.
Can I ask you all to if you had to give like an elevator pitch, just so we have it on the record of what urban theory is, just describe it real quick.
I'm going to let him do that. He's good at that.
So Urban Theory is a human-centered design studio. We help organizations take strategic approaches to very complex social challenges. It's quite a mouthful. So the best way to really sum it up is that we help organizations take on more ambitious challenges, and we help them get past the fuzzy idea stage to actually get tangible, scalable solutions on the ground.
We have 1 minute left. Anything else you want to say?
Man. 1 minute.
We got through that pretty quickly.
It goes fast. I mean, the only other thing that I would say definitely for both of us is our life experiences really primed us to be able to take these experiences and then to also be open-minded enough to, even though it's hard for me because I'm stubborn. And he thinks that I am set in my ways. I'm not. I can listen. I'm open. It's a different traditional mindset, and that's what I appreciate about our friendship.
I think the biggest takeaway for me over all these years and just reflecting on my own life is really just the value of why in that question. I don't think we really ask that question enough in today's society. We kind of just take things for granted, or, oh, that's just the way things are. But I think we need to question that more often and really get deeper into understanding, you know, these topics that, you know, we often consider taboo.
Yeah.